My name's Dot Nichterline. I'm a sociologist. I'm from Valparaiso University, where I'm an administrator for a women's organization, and I also teach sociology classes. The series that I've been doing has to do with the roles and relationships between men and women in American society. And today we're going to be talking about tears and fears, handling our emotions. Now, I'm not sure exactly where we'll go with this, but I will present some ideas which may or may not be familiar to you, and then we'll just take off on whichever direction you want to go. I write an article every month for a publication. It's pretty much whatever I want to write about, and I usually deal with something from a woman's point of view. Dieting, fashions, world problems, just a little bit of everything. And once, a couple of years ago, I wrote an article about tears and emotions, men and women things. And the reason I started to write that article, what gave me the idea for it, was that the state of Illinois had an election, and the governor's race was so close that it took, I think, something like 4 or 5 days before it was decided who was the winner. Some of you might remember reading or hearing about that. And the incumbent governor, Jim Thompson, eventually was declared the winner. But it had taken quite an emotional toll on him to wait, you know, after the hard campaign, to wait until several days had gone by, and it wasn't the sort of thing where they knew, you know, next Friday we're going to know the results. It was day by day by day that they waited to see what happened. Finally, the results were certain, and Big Jim got up in front of the microphones to declare the winner. I'm talking about when Governor Jim Thompson was elected the last time from the state of Illinois. And as he made his talk, he got to a point in his speech in which he wanted to thank his wife and his special supporters for helping him get through this very trying time. And as he talked about that, his voice started to crack, and he had tears in his eyes. And here he was on nationwide TV, breaking down in public. And I thought quite a bit about that, because I remember the election, or the campaign, a number of years ago when Ed Muskie, who was trying to become candidate for president, also broke down in front of reporters and so on. And there were many people who felt at that time that that kind of ruined his chances. And there have been other sorts of situations, too, where that display of humanity has been termed as a weakness for a man, and it's really been difficult for men to face that kind of thing. Well, Jim Thompson, I mean, we call him Big Jim in my part of the world, you know? Nobody could ever imagine him to be a weak person. His record as a politician speaks for itself, and the positions that he takes on many issues and so on, there is just no question about his leadership or his abilities. He's not a sissy in any way. He's not the least bit effeminate in any way, and yet here he was displaying what some people have thought of as kind of female emotions. You know, people who have been concerned about women running for public office have often made a case like that. What if a woman ran for president, was elected, and there in the middle of a cabinet meeting she got tears in her eyes or started to break down? That has been held up as kind of the danger of having a woman in this kind of situation. Well, in the first place, I think there are many things going on in the world in which we ought to cry over them. But quite apart from that, this difference in our views about men and women in treating emotions has been of great interest to me. For much of our history in North America, tears have been seen as a sign of weakness for a man. And in fact, they really have been a sign of weakness. Because if a male is taught from childhood on that he should not express his emotions, he should not cry under any circumstances, and then in some severely stressful situation he actually does cry, that means that he has reached the breaking point. It really is the limits that he has come to. And that means that he faces a problem in thinking of himself as the strong male. He's not living up to that. He is showing a weakness. And that can be a really serious situation for a man. And then I think when a man sees a woman cry, often because this idea has been bred into him that you don't cry unless you have gotten to the point where, you know, you just can't help it. I think that for many men, that kind of is in the back of their minds, maybe not consciously, maybe they don't stop and think that means a woman is weak. But I think they can't help but feel that a woman reaches the breaking point much more quickly than a man does. And that is, in a sense, a sign of weakness, because a woman is called the weaker sex. And this kind of proves it, in a sense.
Mm-hmm. And even the way the phrase breaking down, just to describe crying, mm-hmm. is used, makes it sound as if something terrible has happened.
That's right.
Uh-huh. Something very negative instead of something that could be really good.
But for a woman, crying is not limited to stressful circumstances, is it? I cry in a lot of different kind of situations. I don't know about you, but when the guy gets the girl at the end of the movie, somebody hits a home run or shoots a basket at the last minute, or I'm watching my kids in a play or some other activity, or I hear or read news reports of some awful kind of situation, especially when people are suffering. A piece of beautiful music, particularly one that reminds me of some experience. I mean, I get tears in my eyes and get choked up in all those kinds of situations. And I don't mean to say that I spend all my time boo-hooing, but it is a very common occurrence for me to feel this way. And I think from discussions that I have had with women that I'm not a freak about this, that it's more typical for women to react with tears in a variety of situations. And I think it's getting worse as I get older too. I was going to say also that there have been some times in my life when I have really tried to repress tears or this feeling of being choked up. It usually isn't successful. But I have sometimes tried that, but usually I don't even bother. I just let it come when it's coming. And at the same time, though, I think of myself as a strong person, not as a weak one. And so somehow or another, the way I was brought up, the way girls are brought up, we don't think of tears and emotion as being a sign of weakness, because we can cry and think at the same time. We can cry and act at the same time. It's a part of us, but it does not represent to us getting to the absolute limit where you can't control yourself anymore. So that very view of what is meant by tears or by showing emotion is different for men and women in the whole society. Now, this is changing, of course. And I think that the reason why it's changing, well, there are probably several of them, but one of them is that we are becoming much more aware in studying children that boys and girls in their younger years react very similarly to all kinds of situations. They express fear, anger, pain similarly. And it's only if they are taught to react differently that that seems to be the case as they grow older. And we know this from studying other cultures too. In those cultures in which it's not considered a sign of weakness for a man to cry, men express those emotions just as easily as women do. Would you like to come and sit in the chair? Why not? Why not?
Thank you.
So, again, for a man that has been taught that you don't cry unless you reach your limit, your breaking point, when he really does it, when he gets to that point, he's probably incapable of doing something else at the same time. He's so emotionally distraught. And in other kinds of circumstances, he needs to spend a lot of his energies trying to control himself. Well, I guess from talking to men, after a while, it isn't so difficult to control emotions. You know, you just get used to it. But again, it is a different kind of situation. So when I wrote this article about Jim Thompson, I ended up by saying thanks to him. Thanks for helping to demonstrate that big boys can cry, that it is not being a sissy to cry, to do it in public, even though I know in his case, at that particular moment, it was because of the emotional stress, the lack of sleep, and all the things that went into it. And I said that perhaps between us, we can help demonstrate that men can feel and women can think. You know? And our society needs both of these kinds of things from all of us. By the way, I sent a copy of this to him, and I got a letter back, which was probably written by one of his aides, but it was nice anyway. I put it in my souvenirs. Well, it is, yeah.
Do you think that the other counterpart possibility there is that a man might think that a woman has gotten to the end of her rope whenever she cries, and might overreact about whatever's happening? When we're crying, we can't talk too well sometimes, or at least I can't.
Mm-hmm.
So it might be hard for a few minutes for that woman to really say in words that she's going to get through it okay and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's very possible there's some misunderstanding can go on for a while or two.
I think that's absolutely true. Mm-hmm. And that kind of leads into the next thing that I wanted to say, and that is that it seems in our culture that not only have men been taught in such a way that it's difficult for them to express emotions in some situations, they also have difficulty in dealing with other people's emotions. One example about this has to do with my experience as a teacher. It is not at all uncommon for a student to come and talk to me about, could be a personal problem, or it could be something to do with the course, you know, unsatisfactory grade. It could be a variety of things. And very often students have lack of sleep and anxiety and all those other things. It's not at all uncommon for there to be tears in my office, or in the cafeteria, if that's where we're meeting, or wherever. That doesn't bother me one tiny little bit. I pass the box of Kleenex, and sometimes I even join in. if it's a serious problem that person is going through, sometimes, you know, that's my reaction too, to join right in the tears. And I find that often, almost have to get to the point of the tears and get that over with, and then you can really concentrate on what the problem is. And occasionally it's a young man that gets to this point where he breaks down, and there's that word again. When it's a guy who is so much worried about controlling himself that that that's where his concentration is going. It takes us forever to get to what the real problem is. So I find that sometimes it's very beneficial if there are tears. I find that with my kids too. But in talking to other teachers, I have found that a lot of male instructors have problems when a student cries or becomes emotionally upset. And that means that you can have what's primarily a counseling situation where both people are so concerned about the emotions that they can't get around to dealing with the problem. Well, anyway, that is something that seems to have been a part of our society too, that men have more trouble dealing with other people's emotions. Now, you know, there are always individual differences. This is not true of everybody. But the general patterns seem to be that women have been able to express emotions and to deal with other people's more easily than males have been able to. On the other hand, there is an emotion that men are much more adept at dealing with. What might that be? Anger. Anger. And women have a lot of trouble with that. It's okay for a man to get mad and to act out. It's not always okay for a woman to get mad and express that. Somebody has said that there really are two all-purpose emotions in the world. One is anger, that's used by men, and the other one is tears, and that's used by women. That's probably overstating it, but there's a grain of truth in that, it often seems that a man will give an angry kind of expression to a variety of things. Perhaps fear, perhaps frustration over something, maybe feeling isolated in some sense, and the reaction that comes out is anger. The reaction that comes out of a woman in those kinds of things is more likely to be tears. Now, you know, these are overgeneralizations, and yet that pattern seems to be kind of true. Last week, in the session that I led on the theories of psychologist Carol Gilligan, we found out that when young boys and young girls play games in their own peer groups, that boys are most likely to, when disagreements come along, they kind of settle that so they can get on with the game. And it really doesn't matter for a lot of boys when they choose up sides, if they're best friends on the same team or not. Now, it's the team at the moment and the achievement of the goal that matters the most. But for girls, if disagreements come along, they're much more likely to change the rules or quit the game because the relationships with the other people are what count the most for them, much more than achieving what the goal is. And those kinds of patterns seem to carry on into later life. Let me give you an example from the adult world of what happens sometimes with women. My main job for Valparaiso University is to be the executive director of this women's organization, which is a support group for the university. We have members all over the country. They recruit students, they do publicity work for the university, and they raise money for various campus needs. And my job is to coordinate what's going on all over the country. This is nationwide, and twice a year we have meetings on the campus. So representatives come from all over the country to these two meetings. Now the organization has very clear-cut goals, and people who belong to it are pretty much in agreement about most of the kinds of decisions that are made. And when there are specific decisions that have to be made, like, for example, we have a fund of money, we have to decide how to spend that. You know, it's talked about ahead of time, before a vote is taken, and there's pretty much agreement on what's going to happen. Sometimes there's a surprise, but on the real major things, the officers know pretty well in advance what's going to happen. But occasionally, that isn't the case. And we had a convention a couple of years ago in which there were several serious constitutional changes which were proposed that would have meant a different way of operating. And there were very clearly two sides to the question. And at the convention, people would line up with the microphone to state their opinions on things. There was a very lengthy debate about some of this. It was very difficult for some of the women who were there to listen to this. It was almost as though hearing women stand on opposite sides of a question, it was almost like that was saying, we're not unified anymore. We're not in agreement. There's something wrong with the whole organization. They seemed to feel that was going to cause such a breach that we'd never get back to being where we were before. And even though these debates took up only a small part of the whole convention, and everything else that was going on in the convention was wonderful and unifying and beautiful and all those other good things, there were a few women who really couldn't see all those other things. They were so worried about what was going on in the meanwhile. And I think that is kind of a typical reaction of a lot of women. Now, it's not that women don't disagree with one another. We know they do. And sometimes the arguments that women have with each other can be very petty about very trivial kinds of things. This spring, a girl who belongs to a sorority on my campus told me that she was seriously considering dropping out of the sorority because she said at a couple of meetings they had spent hours trying to decide things like the menu for a dinner that was going to be held. And she said, I've got better things to do with my time. I want to sit and argue with a bunch of girls about something so unimportant. And I think that's true very often in women's groups or among friends, that the disagreements can be very unimportant kinds of things. But yet, when those happen, somehow or another they get smoothed out along the way. But arguing about something that's serious is a different matter for a lot of women. And there are a lot of implications to this. One is that females who go out into the working world where men are very used to disagreeing about things and sorting through alternatives and then coming up with a compromise and going on, that's a different pattern from what a lot of women are used to. And so, especially an older woman who's going back into the labor market for the first time, who hasn't had experience in that kind of situation, can feel very uncomfortable about it. Well, let me just stop here for a minute and see what you have to say about all of this.
I think when you're mentioning about the women in the workforce and the disagreeing, the men don't take it personal, and women do. When you disagree with a coworker about something, if they don't necessarily take it as just disagreeing about that particular work thing, they take it personal, and it's almost like you're attacking them. And mm-hmm. I see that quite often. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
You know, I think that way. She doesn't like this. There's probably a lot more about me that she doesn't like too, and she's just not telling me, and I wonder what it is, and then I get all whipped into a lather. And it sounds so irrational, but it's honestly just, it's not something that I plan to do. Mm-hmm. It's just the way, chain reaction or something.
Mm-hmm.
And it feels like that I'm not disciplined or I'm not in control at that point.
So it also makes you tend, if you don't like for something, is it being done right, hold back and not necessarily tell someone because you don't want to get in that situation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, suffer in silence. And that has some implications for marriage, of course.
Aren't there subtle ways, though, that women deal with anger that are, can be, in some regards, possibly more greater depth than with man? It's the subtle ways that, that anger between, particularly two women, can be dealt towards each other. It's not as visible as it is with a male, but, mm-hmm. but yet it's there.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
Are you talking about dealing with anger, like learning to accept that I feel angry, or are you talking about dealing out anger?
Dealing out, I guess is what I'm referring to more.
Yeah.
To another person who you're angry toward, particularly another woman. I've talked to women about this before, and that's where I'm coming up with it. It's mm-hmm. not in my head, but other women have told me before that they deal differently with anger by the way in which they relate to the person who they're angry toward. Whereas a guy will physically do something, a woman might do something a little bit more discreet, but yet just as potent, or not more so.
Words, I'm sure.
Get you one way or another.
Non-direct method.
Effective method.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I tend to avoid the person as much as possible, so I don't have to deal with it.
Well, I think it's a very, you know, in my home, I mean, pet harmony at all costs. And I think when you're raised that way, which I think was very common mm-hmm. back when I was being raised, that it becomes very risky and threatening. I can remember watching my sister, who was younger than I am, having a very strong argument as an adult with a friend of hers. And I knew that they wanted to argue in private. And yet I sat there as long as I felt comfortable because I wanted to see how it was going to come out. I couldn't imagine that two people that angry with each other would ever get it back together. Mm-hmm. And of course, within the hour they had. Mm-hmm. And that is still a difficulty to me.
Mm-hmm. Do you find sometimes that women who are angry with each other, it's kind of like they change the subject and they let it out on something else instead of the major thing that's really separating them from that? Something that's not quite as serious.
Well, I used to play soccer till I hurt myself really bad, and I know a lot of the women in my group said that's, they loved it because they could get out there and beat that ball around the field and stuff and take out a lot of their frustrations that way and then cope better with their mm-hmm. families and other things too.
Mm-hmm.
I play the piano really loudly when I'm angry. And then I feel better. But Addison hasn't really resolved in the conflict.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe you can look at it more rationally,
yeah.
Not with so much anger.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I've found that I'm apt to lash out in anger with the ones closest in my own family and at home, but with other people that I don't know as well, and then I tend to repress it. I've kind of learned a little bit to express more with other people too, because repressing it doesn't really do that much good either,
mm-hmm.
hidden, but learning to express it in a I feel way rather than you make me so mad.
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think it is along the same line, the depth of your relationship with someone, whether you will avoid the subject or you will you'll address it. And I think that's kind of what she's saying too.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's the level of safety that you have with that person.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if anybody else sees a considerable difference in generational age.
know that the, I don't know if I should call them older generation, but I'm thinking of my parents who definitely are older. But there's a generation where this peace at all costs was pretty.
Well, I think, yeah, that's
true, especially in Christian families, I expect. And then their kids, my generation, somehow in living life, after a few years, we realized that that didn't solve some of the problems that come up with your loved ones. And we got a little more assertive. And I think our kids, my kids at least, are even more so. And they just blurt things out. And they know I'm not going to take it all too seriously because I've heard it so long. So I'll, you know, they can get away. And I, although they had to learn that too for the first times. But I think there's been some change. That's just my own personal perspective on it. But I wonder if anybody else sees that.
I think that's pretty accurate. I think I'm one that I'll just say what I feel, and I regret that. I think that there's a lot of lack of self-control, a lack of sensitivity for others, that for the sake of my feeling better.
Mm.
And sometimes I wish I was in a situation where peace was strived for rather than my feeling better.
You'd like to go back?
Yeah. I'd like to
go back to the peaceful generation.
Yeah, we can go through a cycle again. My kids can.
But isn't it the perspective in which you're looking at it? Because sometimes the speaking out is going to create the peace, whereas peace at all costs is only going to create a lot more tension, which is only going to not create peace. Yeah, yeah. So it depends on, yeah, it depends on, I think, how you look at it and how you move along with it from start to finish.
Mm-hmm. To temper, I think you do need to temper that, though. To express yourself, but still be concerned about.
There was a great guitar song last night in the lift. We just finished over here talking about prayer, and I went down there about 10 o'clock, and she was thinking about solving a problem with a roommate, but waiting until she was calm enough to say it in love.
Mm.
You know, they were going on in a guitar session that was similar to what had just been said up here, and I was impressed by the way folk music can do it too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I have found if I'm angry about something, if I write it down, just for my own benefit, before I ever say if I have something I'm angry with my husband about, which doesn't happen very often, but if I write it down first, then it seems much more, my anger is subdued, mm-hmm. and it seems less important.
Journal keeper?
No,
we were talking about that in journal the other night too.
No, I often I'll write something down and then I'll put it in the trash and that's the end of it.
Or sometimes maybe it gives you a second look at it and you realize that it was something else repressed and was maybe triggered it, and that's not what was originally meant. Okay.
Yeah. Just a few days ago this happened. I was quite upset about something, not with my husband, but something else, and I wrote it down, and I was going to send this to a person, but I kept it overnight, and I read it up. I decided it wasn't that important.
Boy, that sounds familiar to me.
That's a version of count to 10,
huh? Yeah, that's right.
I came in on the tail end of a family of six, and philosophy was you're to be seen and not heard as children. I know my parents argued and disagreed, but never in front of us children. And anger was never expressed. There was silence. And I repaid the price for that as I grew older, because I had a hard time expressing my anger, because I had kind of been taught that it was not right to do.
Mm-hmm.
And
a lot of that teaching goes on without words, doesn't it?
Yes, yes. And it's been just a marvelous release to come to terms with that and to discuss that agenda with, you know, someone experienced in the counseling mm-hmm. field and to be freed of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I know my parents meant well. You know, they did the best they knew how. But, mm-hmm. It really has this scar with me.
what I think is encouraging. I teach elementary students, and they're doing so much now in the school. I mean, every grade in the school, I mean, has a self-image unit, and a big part of that is feelings and discussing them. And, you know, I'm just so impressed with how insightful children are and, mm-hmm. and how able they are in their simple way to get right at the heart and be able to share some feelings. And some, for some it might take most of the year, but, you know, as they get safer, right? I think it's very encouraging to see this being happening.
It also says something about the educational system that's able to examine what's going on in people's lives and make some adjustments.
Mm-hmm. And in a sense, about the family lacks. If the family doesn't teach feelings, you have to teach it in school. If the family doesn't teach sex ed, then we in school try to take it over because we know it has to be done or should be done. That's mm-hmm. my school perspective, too. Mm-hmm. But in a way, it says something about what families yeah. aren't doing, doesn't it? As well as saying what kids need.
I think parents are asking for it too in many cases. They're saying, hey, you know, help us. Give us some help. How do we go about it?
Well, there's obviously a balance in all this emotional business. I mean, not everything is worth fighting over. Not everything is worth expressing anger over. Not everything is worth crying over. It's learning how to deal maturely with different kinds of situations, and I also think it part of it comes down to understanding ourselves and what our own limits are, and how we can put together the different parts of our lives and express our true selves in the best way possible.
How can we help men, including our own children or spouses, to become a little more free and not to think that we think they're cracked up, mm-hmm. breaking down?
Yeah, it's hard. I have a son that's 10. Sometimes he'll get hurt. I know he wants to cry, and sometimes he does, but other times he don't. And especially it's cold. I can't cry then. You know, mm-hmm. I said it doesn't matter. Oh, they all laugh at me, you know.
And they will.
Yeah, they will. Mm-hmm. And it makes you feel really bad for them because you know they feel better if they could cry.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And mommy telling them it's okay to do it isn't going to do it because those other boys are standing there mm-hmm. laughing, and that's who they care about.
I don't think mom can tell. I think it's going to have to be dad.
Yeah.
In the sense of a little boy. The boy needs that model. Mm-hmm. And society hasn't okay. offered that model before.
But maybe dad has had some of those experiences he could give out that makes it feel better.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do see a change going on. I notice it among students. I talked to, last year I was involved in the workshop for the resident assistants, the counselors who live in the dormitories with the other kids. And the ones who had done this before were asked to tell about their experiences and answer questions about it. And I asked one of them, one of the guys who's in the men's dormitory, what do you do when somebody cries? You know? I mean, 18-year-old guys living in the dormitory with all other young men who are about the same age, that's a real difficult thing for them to they face a problem that severe. I said, do they break down? And this girl said yes, says it happens much more often than you would think. And he talked to the other people who would be entering, you know, into this kind of situation about dealing with this. And one of the things he said was, it was valuable to
to help these guys try to put themselves in one another's situation. And to realize that even though I myself have tried to suppress my emotions all the time, there would be situations in which that would be a very good thing to do, to be able to release that. And if someone else is releasing his emotions, I should be thinking that is good for him to be able to do that. You know, instead of, oh, look at that. So I gathered out of that in the younger generation, there are more sensitivities now.
Tonight's session is going to be on homophobia, or the fear of being thought to be a homosexual. I have worked for a long time in high school, where I think it's clearly rampant to have that fear, and everyone in the hallway has to be very careful who they bump into, let alone touch in any way, et cetera, et cetera. This crime, there must be a name for fear of being thought a crybaby. You know, and I think it goes through this stage somewhere between 10 and 20 at its height. There must be a bell curve about it somewhere where it, you know, your peers are at you the most fiercely. And as you get older and a little more mature and maybe more educated, then people, actually men, can go up and cry with each other once in a while, or put their arm on each other and feel like they can comfort another person. I see that sort of thing in this age and growing up phase. It's okay for 5-year-olds, and it's probably okay for 25-year-olds, but boy, that little bunch of years.
You know, I think some of that comes to, you know, they're taught, like, in the grades about, you know, abuse, you know, abusive parents and so forth.
Yeah, and
my 13-year-old, I really noticed after he had that in school, he was just, you know, I couldn't touch him in public. You know, he just was, you know, and he, I know he thinks about that, you know, it's okay, I could, you know, at home. You know, but he, real concern, maybe 13 too, being he's so conscious of his peer. But you know, they're being exposed to so many more things like than we were. I mean, we weren't worried
about that.
We're just concerned about abuse that, you know, when we were young. So they have all these pressures and all these things to be thinking about.
Yeah, and I try to always teach them, be sure that you don't think I'm saying that you shouldn't ever have hugs from people that love you. That's good touching. We talk about good touching and uncomfortable touching. Mm-hmm. But I think they do sometimes overgeneralize it a little bit. And sometimes say, okay, all touching is off, or something. But I think it's partly that age and the peer thing, too, that's going on. I wonder if anybody else sees this this stressful time for not crying as I do at a certain age there. Or maybe it's educational. If you take 25-year-olds, there's still a lot of macho folks around who would be caught dead crying. You know, and the ones that I know that are sensitive men are generally the more educated ones. But maybe that's just my experience.
There's some support for that in the stuff that I have read, that there is a class difference in emotionality, but there's also a nationality difference. And people who come from cultures in which it is not looked down upon are much more easily emotional. They can, in the next generation, sometimes suffer the consequences of that, you know, as they try to fit into American society and subject to the same kind of peer pressures as everyone else. But still, if they're used to... I had a student friend, a very special young man in my life, who was from an Italian family. And he said, he told me one time, he said, if you grow up in an Italian family, and his parents were both born in the United States, so it wasn't an immediate immigrant situation. If you grow up in an Italian family, everybody's laughing and yelling and screaming and hugging and everything all at the same time. He said, when you get to public school, where there's every other kind of person, you try to hide some of that in yourself, but you never can get rid of it. And this guy was, he was a football captain, fraternity president, real comfortable with people all the time. And that was partly his personality, but it was also partly the fact that he was sensitive to other people. You know, it was one of the things I liked about him most. In fact, I would think about, what is it that I like about people who I call my friends? Because they're also different from one another. And it was after I met him and started thinking, what is it I really like about him, that I discovered what it is in friendship that appeals to me. It's people who care about other people. That's the first thing that gets through to me in someone else. And that's the kind of person he was. And not only did he have the sensitivity towards other people, but because of his background, he could express that really easily. So I say to him, yeah, well, I'm glad you can't get rid of it, because that's a really special characteristic. And he influenced a lot of people to let go. So class differences and nationality differences are there.
Well, in different children out of the same family will be, one will be the opposite of the other.
That's true, sure.
And they're raised the same way as the other one.
Mm-hmm. It's really interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. I had five, and I sure bought them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, another thing that's related to this fear that young boys have about being thought of as maybe effeminate, that appears in the books that are written about these kinds of things, is that in a society where women are kind of looked down on, maybe not totally, but in some aspects, young boys grow up not wanting ever to be thought of in any feminine way, because that's putting them down. And I think that enters into our whole problem that we have had with expressing emotion and being comfortable about being close to one another and so on. If it looks like you're being a sissy,
or
looks
if
like you're being...
grow like a girl.
Yeah.
That attitude, right?
Uh-huh.
And girls are being put down by statements.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Now again, that's changing in our society.
Yes, because some of those girls will turn around and say, I can do a lot better than you, boy.
I am trying to not say that anymore, I don't think. Most teachers are sensitive enough not to make a remark like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's elderly aunts and uncles that might be your danger point.
My gal told me that last week.
Mom, you look real like that.
And he gave me a lecture. That one of the teachers had me at public too, some into the classroom, and the little girls didn't take it.
I love it.
And the male mm-hmm. teacher too. Maybe they've had enough of their generation. They've heard their moms talking about it.
Yeah.
And yes.
Go ahead.
On the other hand, it can be a compliment, so-called, to tell a girl, you think like a boy, or a woman, you think like a man. Mm-hmm. So I mean, it does say something about the values of men and women. And I do believe that is changing. But it's still a part of our culture.
You kind of answer, you not answer your question, because we need the answer, but what can we do to help boys and men and so on? I think as women sometimes in our relating to them, if we see them getting to an emotional level, and if we can give them permission, let them know it's okay. I work with junior high students, and every once in a while I don't do it enough, but I will tune into a student that I can see is just ready to cry, for example. And usually it's just before it comes a lot of anger or silence or looking down or whatever. And giving them permission, saying it's okay. And maybe moving the Kleenex box close to them.
I think the gentleman's idea of having a man do that, it may be a real important another step that we ought to work on more. Men teachers or our fathers saying, like Rosie Greer in that song,
it's okay to cry.
Rosie Greer, yeah.
Last summer I did hospital chaplaincy in a medical center in Houston, and whenever there was a death that occurred and I was with the family, you could tell 9 times out of 10 that the man just wanted to break down and cry, just really wanted to let go. And I don't know how many times I said, you know, it's okay, you know, to them, and as soon as I said that, boom, it came, but not until then.
The permission was it,
especially in the light of another male being present. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I think when men have experienced that kind of thing, they have gone through a long struggle of illness, and together they can, you know, they are experiencing that. I know a situation where a father and a son have experienced the long, long illness of a mother and a wife, and now even months after, how they embrace each other, and you know, I know they've gone through some difficult times, and it's okay for them to cry in front of each other and to care.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it takes that sort of a tragedy to show you how important it is to express the feelings, things that were never said. After a time of tragedy in my family, we're saying so much more.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're much more vulnerable to cry. I mean, it kind of gets in the way of things at times, mm-hmm. but that's also positive.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I have to share this because this was really an experience for me. I had a brother who was diagnosed with cancer and died within 6 months. He had 3 boys. 32, 25, 22, something like that in ages, and also 2 daughters. And he knew he was dying. And he called me, and he lived in Chicago, and I was in Minnesota, and he and I were very close. And he called me and he said, today my family is coming up, and I've ordered extra Kleenex. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he as a father was going to give his sons permission to cry. Mm-hmm. And after they had that traumatic day, he was able to say, you know, we went through a lot of Kleenex. And the kids now, you know, it's not difficult for them to let the tears come and to mm-hmm. even express their sadness because they had a father who said, that's okay. This is what we're going to do today.
Mm-hmm.
And he did it in such a nice way. Mm-hmm. And there was no more denial about it. This is what's happening to me. And those boys had that chance.
For me, my father, my mom and dad were divorced when I was real young, and then my father later died after they were divorced. And so the first 7 years of my life, I was predominantly raised by my mother during formative years. And I think having her as a role model, even though I had my grandfather on the side and my uncle on the side, her as my role model helped me deal with emotions that are probably different from most men. And I really consider it an advantage. And then I guess the guys that I've shared that with at seminary that have similar backgrounds have felt the same way, but then there are those who have come from traditional sins who I have sometimes much more difficulty relating to because of that difference in the background.
Mm-hmm.
But having my mother predominantly raise me in those first 7 years, she gave me the okay permission to go ahead and to be myself and not have to be something I wasn't. But it was tough growing up in those high school and junior high years because in the midst of that I still had, I guess to a degree, that macho image that I wanted to to, I wanted to be like the rest of the guys, and so I played ball, and boy, I had trouble relating to those guys. There was definitely a difference between a rationality. So, I don't know what the answer is, but I do think that permission, you know, my mom gave me that permission, and that background made a big difference, too.
We see in society, not only our own, but in many, but that males and females act differently and in some situations play different roles and so on. And I think that some of the differences we have do come out as our biological difference. But in many ways, we are the same. And the chance to be fully human, to have all parts of ourselves, a part of our lives, not just hidden away somewhere, but really expressed, I think is very valuable. And,